I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Things got testy at the White House press briefing yesterday when Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders vented about what she called the barrage of fake news aimed at the president. She complained about the relentless focus on the, quote, Trump-Russia hoax and called out CNN that had retracted a report involving Anthony Scaramucci, who was part of the Trump transition team. CNN had apologized for the story and three journalists at the network had resigned. President Trump tweeted yesterday, so they caught fake news CNN cold. But what about NBC, CBS, and ABC? What about the failing New York Times and Washington Post? They are all fake news. Here's Sanders and Brian Karam. He's White House reporter for Sentinel Newspapers, who confronted her at Tuesday's briefing.
News outlets get to go on day after day and cite unnamed sources, use stories without sources, have, you mentioned the Scaramucci story where they had to have reporters resign.
Come on, you're inflaming everybody right here, right now with those words. This administration has done that as well. Why in the name of heavens? Any one of us, right, are replaceable, and any one of us, if we don't get it right, the audience has the opportunity to turn the channel or not read us.
I think you have
been elected to serve for 4 years at least. There's no option other than that. We're here to ask you questions.
Right.
You're here to provide the answers. And what you just did is inflammatory to people all over the country who look at it and say, see, once again, the president is right and everybody else out here is fake media. And everybody in this room is only trying to do their job.
Well, I disagree completely. First of all, I think if anything has been inflamed, it's the dishonesty that often takes place by the news media. And I think it is outrageous for you to accuse me of inflaming a story when I was simply trying to respond to his question.
Well, today on Radio Times, the changing landscape of journalism in the age of President Trump. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio is Will Bunch. He's national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Philly.com, author of the blog called Attitude. Will, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's good to be here.
Good to have you with us. And also with us is Paul Farhi. He's media reporter for The Washington Post. And Paul, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So what do you make of Brian Karam's complaint and kind of pushback for or against Sarah Huckabee Sanders?
Well, I think he speaks for everybody. We aren't responsible for one flawed story by one news outlet, and for her to demonize all of us is outrageous, and he expressed it pretty well. About how the White House has treated the media. It wants to demonize us, and it has done so since Trump was a candidate. And it's continuing. There's a kind of low-level war between the press and the White House, and we're seeing it play out every day at those briefings.
How do you see this low-level war, Will Bunch?
Well, it was interesting when I heard Paul say he speaks for everybody. That has to be qualified. I mean, he spoke for everybody in the media. He didn't speak for everybody in the country. And I mean, what we're seeing here is just a very calculated strategy by the Trump White House. I mean, you have a presidency that has a real lack of accomplishments on issues from healthcare to taxes to foreign policy. And, the way that the president is keeping his support and holding his base together is by rallying his supporters against the media. And that was the tactics that you saw Sarah Huckabee Sanders using yesterday, for this huge broadside against the media. And it's a dog whistle to the people who still support Trump, who are still watching this. And it's ugly politics. It's wrong. But they found it's very effective for what they're trying to do. It's unfortunate.
Well, Paul, let me go back to you. You had a piece in the Washington Post today about this CNN story essentially saying that it's bad timing, if I can put it that way. But it does raise, I guess, a couple of questions about CNN and perhaps the kind of competition get out some of these stories to beat the competition. Explain what you were saying in this story this morning.
Well, the bad timing has both a specific and a general quality to it. The specific thing was that the top editor, one of the people who resigned, was actually out of the office when the story was being produced and posted by CNN. He was traveling to Phoenix and was it's not clear that he actually had a whole lot to do with it. He took responsibility for it. The more general question is what came out of the briefing yesterday, and it was what has been an issue around the press since Trump began as a candidate, which is, you know, when you call out Trump, when you produce something that that Trump doesn't like, he's going to go at you. And that's what we're seeing, again, what we saw yesterday from Sarah Huckabee Sanders. So, you know, the press has to be on edge all the time. It has to get its facts right. It cannot afford the kind of slip-up that we saw in that CNN thing, because it will be used as a cudgel against all of us, and it will be used as a talking point to say that the media is fake news and gets stuff wrong all the time.
So, Paul, the media has to be perfect? They cannot make a mistake?
Yes. More or less. It's a ridiculous standard, of course. We're human beings. We make mistakes. We're going to make mistakes. There are going to be stories that are wrong. But what you're seeing is using this as a prop to say that all of it is discredited and all of it is fake. And as broad and ridiculous as that sounds, that is exactly mm-hmm. what is going on, and that is exactly the strategy from the Trump administration.
Well, and I'm not just to beat up on CNN here, but I'm thinking of firing Kathy Griffin after she held up that just strange, macabre, ridiculous, head of a bloody President Trump. Reza Aslan got fired for insulting the president. What do you see going on here?
Well, right. I think you have a conservative infrastructure. You know, the conservative media from Breitbart, talk radio, and a Trump White House that's kind of working in tandem with them, looking for these examples of things that can justify their rallying cry, which is fake news. You know, when your rallying cry is fake news, the implication is that most or all of the news is fake. And instead, you're seeing cherry picking examples. And again, Kathy Griffin is not even a journalist; she's an entertainer, right? But who happens to be on CNN once a year for this kind of goofy New Year's Eve show, right?
Exactly.
So I don't know if that makes her a journalist. I would argue it probably doesn't. But look, I mean, the bigger picture here is, you know, if you look at the totality of the evidence, we're dealing with the most corrupt administration, at least since Nixon, and maybe in American history.
Do we know that?
I think so. When you look at the whole emoluments issue, as they call it, with Trump still retaining his business interests, still he and his family still doing these deals from China to Turkey to all these other countries, and still retaining these business interests.
But they got the okay from the organizations that were supposed to that sign off on this stuff.
Well, not everything that's corrupt is illegal, for one thing.
I got you.
And of course, as we know, there is a special counsel, and there are numerous investigations to potential illegality by Trump's campaign. Every day there's a new headline. Today we learned that Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign advisor for a time, was paid $17 million by the pro-Russia faction in Ukraine. And we're learning about this stuff through journalism. We're learning about this through dozens of stories that are published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Reuters, AP. So many news outlets have done yeoman's work to bring these stories to the forefront. Right. And, most of these stories are not fake news. And so, like I said, I mean, they're cherry picking. If I can just use a quick example, sure. I don't know how many listeners have seen the movie All the President's Men about Woodward and Bernstein and how they uncovered Watergate. Some of the dramatic tension in the story is at one point they made a mistake. They got a story wrong about grand jury testimony, and the story was essentially retracted. I mean, you have to wonder if that had happened in today's climate, would Woodward and Bernstein have been fired to satisfy the Nixon White House? Would Nixon have finished out his second term? You have to wonder about the difference between the climate then and now.
Well, Paul, it seems like no presidents, certainly in my lifetime, have had much love for the press corps. Is there anything uniquely different about this president. I mean, I say that knowing that he has called the press the enemy of the people. He's talked about, making really pretty disparaging comments, scum, dishonest about the press. Are we in unique territory here?
Well, I would say yes and no in some ways. It's just more extreme. As you point out, every president, including Obama, who my emailers think we gave a pass to, has called out the press on one at one point or another. But Trump makes it a part of his daily diet. You wake up in the morning and you'll see tweets from him about the media. Today he went after the Washington Post, calling us a tool of Amazon. It's more of a central strategy, more of a central aspect of this administration than any in my lifetime. And, it is his way. It is an issue every single day for him in a way that it has never been for any other president that I can remember.
Let me quote something from Reporters Without Borders. I did a survey of press around the world. One of the things they said about President Barack Obama, it bears repeating that Obama left behind a flimsy legacy for press freedom and access to information. The Obama administration waged a war on whistleblowers who leaked information about its activities, leading to the prosecution of more leakers than every previous administration combined. Now, Will, we're only a couple of months into the Trump administration, and he certainly talked about using libel laws and complaining about leaks. But it seems that Obama, at least at this point, takes the cake on that.
Well, I mean, it was very disappointing, the Obama presidency, when it came to press freedom. And in fact, the annual ranking that the groups do of press freedom, the U.S.'s ranking declined under Obama. And the fact that he had this harsh policy towards whistleblowers after promising as a candidate that he would protect whistleblowers, it's one of several campaign promises that he broke around press freedom. He also promised the most transparent White House in history, and yet when it came to freedom of information requests and that sort of thing, his administration was really no better and in some ways worse than some of the presidents before. So it was very disappointing. But, I'd have to go back to we can't forget that, but we also, Trump is, as Paul said, has taken it to a whole different level. I mean, and a level that I think is just
personal. It's
alarming. I mean, I think we all saw the rally where he got up there and he called the media, quote, the enemy of the American people, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And at other times he's called them the worst people, scum. I don't know if he's used that word, but that's basically the implication. And, if you watch newsreels of the authoritarian movements that overtook Europe in the 20th century, it's exactly the same shtick. It's exactly the authoritarian playbook to have these big rallies to stir up hatred. The kind of Orwellian 2 minutes hate that he does against the media and turns the audience to the crowd and people. And I've been to Trump rallies, and this is the overarching theme of his supporters there. The last one I went to in Hershey, when I went up to people like, why are you here? What do you have to say for yourself? The first thing that came out of their lips was CNN sucks.
Oh, interesting.
That's why that was the thing that brought them to this rally. I mean, it's a unifying force, and it's a dangerous force in society.
And that's Will Bunch. He's national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Philly.com. Also with us, Paul Farhi. He's media reporter for the Washington Post. We are talking about the press in the age of Trump, what it's like to cover the president and his administration. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, members of the White House press corps covering the Obama administration told a 2014 survey that it was the worst beat in politics. It was miserable and claustrophobic. White House reporters covering the Trump administration are frustrated because of the daily briefings. Sean Spicer and Sarah Huckabee Sanders not answering their questions. Fewer live, on-the-record, on-camera Q&A sessions replaced with off-the-record gaggles. Here's CNN White House reporter Jim Acosta on Monday after the White House blocked a video feed of briefings.
John, can you answer whether the president still believes the question?
There's no camera on, Jim.
But maybe we should turn the cameras on, John. Why don't we turn the cameras on?
Jen.
Why don't we turn the cameras on?
I'm sorry that you have to do. Jen, go ahead.
Why not turn the cameras on, Sean? They're in the room. The lights are on.
Josh Dossi joining us now. He's White House reporter for Politico. Josh, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And Will Bunch staying with us, along with Paul Farhi. Why are cameras important for these daily briefings, Josh?
Well, I think it gives the public a record of what the president's saying. You can hear it yourself. You can see it yourself. And, you know, if it's true, then you know that. If it's not true, then you know that. I mean, it's all there for posterity's sake. And it's there for the entire public to say, here's how they're defending themselves. Here's what the administration is saying to you. Here's what your government is doing. And I think it's just a basic, you know, function of government that people should be able to see what their president and what their administration is doing.
Paul, what do you think about that? Is it important to see and not just hear?
Certainly. The reason the cameras were there in the first place was exactly as Josh says, so that people can see what the White House has to say in real time. And when you take away that camera, you know, this is what the Washington Post slogan refers to, democracy dying in darkness. There's no reason for it other than a political expediency by the White House. They don't want that camera there because perhaps they're embarrassed or don't want to account for what they have done or plan to do. And, you know, I think people, as a practical matter, should be quite upset about it because it's a diminishment of our democratic rights, a small one, but a significant one.
How do you see press briefings, Will?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, it's 2017. We have the technology, right? I mean, so why would you turn off the camera other than you're playing a game? Either you don't want certain answers to questions to be circulated as you want. The other thing, though, I think that's going on here is I think they're trying to provoke conflict with the media because, again, getting back to what we were discussing earlier, I mean,
right.
I think this is their political strategy. I think they do best with their base when they're at war with the media, and the best way to have a war start any war is to provoke the other side. And so, you know, they provoke journalists like Jim Acosta, who I think absolutely is right on the money in his criticisms, but then, you know, we're at war with Jim Acosta, and they use that to raise money. They use that to go on Breitbart and on, you know, Rush Limbaugh and on Fox News and stir up the base.
One of the complaints, Josh, is that the media, I guess you people, use these press briefings for your own PR, as a way to get on television, as a way to promote yourself. That's the perspective that we hear coming from the Trump White House. What do you say?
Well, I think it's a bit puzzling. I mean, a lot of these questions are just trying to piece through, you know, discrepancies in the White House accounts, questions that Sean Spicer says he simply cannot answer that are basic questions, like, does the president believe in climate change? You know, has a president spoken to a certain person? These briefings become a spectacle because the president tweets, you know, things like alleging tapes. I mean, the White House strings us along for weeks and won't answer the question, or the president won't delineate his position on a matter. I mean, in some ways, these have become, you know, these high-octane, must-see TV affairs. But a lot of it is because, you know, we're trying to parse through things that on their face often seem nonsensical. And that makes for some very interesting exchanges, to say the least.
Well, hold on, Paul, just one little second here. Here's a very short montage of Press Secretary Sean Spicer declining to answer questions at several recent press briefings.
I don't have that at this time. Yeah, I have not had an opportunity to have that discussion. I have not, as I mentioned, Zeke, I have not had an opportunity to specifically talk to the president about that. I don't know at this point.
Is that stonewalling, Paul?
Well, I was going to say, I would only wish that the White House press briefings were high octane. I've watched dozens of them, and they're basically pretty boring. What you do see in these is reporters from all sides of the political spectrum asking legitimate questions and getting exactly what your tape there showed, which is non-answers. The press secretaries have essentially rendered these as pointless exercises because they can't or won't answer the questions. And that's what the cameras will show. Not a whole lot of debate and conflict, but the non-responsiveness of the administration.
Well, Josh, is there grumbling among White House reporters like yourself about the fact that you're not getting answers to your questions? And is there anything you can do about it, like walk off, not be there for the daily briefing?
So I don't know if that makes sense to do. I do think there's a frustration that, you know, sometimes with a press shop, it's hard to get, you know, basic questions answered. But there are, you know, various factions in this White House who often, you know, leak on each other. I mean, in some ways, this White House is more transparent than I think in previous White Houses, because you have, you know, lots of people who dislike each other inside the building, lots of people who have their own motives, who are willing to talk to reporters. So I think through official channels, there's been, you know, a dulling down of access and kind of this, you know, darkness, so to speak, of answering questions. But you know, some of the reporting I read out of the White House from, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times and us and others are illuminating accounts of exactly what's going on inside the building. So I don't think it's stopping journalism on its face. It's just being done in a different way.
Being done through leaks, you're saying there, Josh?
Yeah, and through, you know, deeply sourced accounts from reporters who have covered this administration. You know, a lot of the stuff that I read about the president are kinds of lenses into his mind and his thinking that I've never seen about a previous president on such a daily basis. And you know, he wakes up in the morning and posts things on Twitter that 6:15 in the morning that are thoughts that, you know, we would have never seen through even President Nixon. You know, whatever things we learned about President Nixon were on tapes released, you know, decades later, or, you know, through historical archives from, you know, Kennedy and others. I mean, here, the president just tweets it.
Well, let me pick up on that. And in certain ways, Will, he is feeding the press or feeding the media with his tweets. He tweeted this morning.
Well, he's feeding the media, but he's also going around it, and this is, again, this is something that is not new to Trump. I mean, it's ever since the rise of the internet and then especially social media with Facebook, you know, I mean, there are so many ways, you know, this is one of the fundamental questions of the time. It gets back to some of the other issues that we're not really talking about today, but the actual fake news that circulated during the 2016 election on Facebook and other social media, you know, Trump's tweets are part of that bigger picture of how do people get information, and the fact that, you know, in when Richard Nixon was president during Watergate, people got their news from four sources, basically four or five sources, their hometown newspaper, because there was no internet, and from Walter Cronkite, and then the other two networks, right? So this is a way for him to communicate directly. I mean, unfortunately, he uses that tool. Many of these tweets have been found to have been blatantly wrong or dishonest. So that's unfortunate, but that's, you know. Just picking up on one other thing that sure. Josh was talking about is that, you know, I mean, as he pointed out, I mean, the real action of covering this White House is not at the press briefing. Some of it, like he said, is from the leaks. And the other stuff, I mean, so much of the best journalism that's going on right now is done by people who aren't setting foot in the White House. I mean, David Fahrenholt, who just won the Pulitzer Prize, is the ultimate example, just had another great story yesterday about, speaking of fake news, Time magazine cover that Donald Trump hangs up in his golf clubs. He didn't have to go to a White House briefing to do that. He's on the phone. He's talking to people. We call it shoe leather reporting, even if that's not what it is anymore. But that's what's really needed more of.
Are you saying there's no reason to have White House briefings or even reporters who are in the White House covering the White House?
One of my favorite media critics is Jay Rosen, who's a professor at NYU University. One of his biggest points that he's made during the Trump years is when it comes to the briefings, he says, send the interns, you know, send the basic people who can, you know, ask the basic questions that come from the newsroom and get the basic responses. And the people with, you know, 30 years of experience who are the best journalists in the world don't waste their time at these dog and pony shows, that they should be doing what David Fahrenholt is doing, and they should be out there in the streets digging, you know. And that's I couldn't agree with that more.
Well, let me give Josh.
I would disagree.
Yeah, go ahead.
That, actually.
Go ahead. Let me give Josh, only because he's White House reporter for Politico. Let me give him a chance to respond. And then, Paul, I'll give you a chance to respond as well. Josh, go ahead.
I disagree with that slightly. I think these briefings are important because, you know, the administration has to speak for itself. You know, we have to pose these tough questions. You know, a lot of folks in the American public are smart. They can see stonewalling. They can see when folks aren't telling the truth. I mean, it's all visible. It's there, you know, in the public eye. I mean, I agree that there's not a lot of true answers that come out of these briefings on many days. But at the same time, having them as, you know, a focus of democracy to the point, they have to explain themselves. And when they can't explain themselves or they refuse to explain themselves, then that's an answer of itself in many ways.
Paul, go ahead. And I'm thinking about, even if you don't get answers to tough questions, you get to hear the tough questions.
You've made all my points.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's sorry. Quite all right. You know, there is no question that the David Fahrenthalds of the world are very valuable, but the briefings are the public face of the administration. And by the way, press conferences, which Trump is not having any longer, these are things that the people can see directly, as opposed to the process of reporting, which often relies on anonymous sources and background information. This is the way the public can see what the administration is doing and saying for their own eyes, and it is a record of their statements. And if they are going to diminish that, we've lost one element, an important element of the accountability that all government, all American governments are responsible for.
Sunlight. Let me get Douglas from Phoenixville to join our conversation. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I just want to talk about the role of money in journalism. You know, I am no fan of Trump. I'm against many of the things he does. But and his way of expressing his frustration with the press, I think, is overly general and broad. But my frustration with it is that I feel that many outlets are influenced by the commercial interests that are sponsoring them. And the worst example, and it's very easy to see, is Fox. Fox is clearly almost what I would call to be fake news, or their editorial decisions are so skewed that it's not balanced. Okay, but the point is that this is not just Fox. This is like across the board. Commercial journalism is influenced at the highest level by these commercial interests, and this includes NPR. NPR.
Well, we're not commercial, but that's okay.
You take commercial money though, at this point, right? Like, well, if I asked how much
mostly
how much
from
money
our listeners, but yeah.
Pharmaceutical companies, for example, how much do they give to NPR? I don't know. I'm sure it's a lot. So are you going to have negative stories about the
Well, actually, we have Douglas had. I don't want to get into what we do or don't cover here on NPR or Radio Times or HYY. But there is, there is this. It's sometimes an imperfect, but there is a firewall between the money that comes in. That's certainly here true here at WHYY and the kind of stories that we cover. Paul, do you want to just do a quick response to Doug? And Doug's not alone in his complaint about the impact of money on journalism.
Sure, but I would also point out that this is an evergreen, has been true for at least 100 years. It's nothing new about that. I've worked at the Washington Post now for 29 years. It's a long time, and I could not tell you who our advertisers are. I wish we had more of them, but I really, as a practical matter, can't tell you who's spending money to advertise in our paper. And I would say most journalists are probably the same way. The more important point, I think, in terms of our vested interest is who our readers and viewers are, who we perceive them to be, and what their expectations are. Do we, as journalists, play to their prejudices, their biases, and their expectations? That is a more central point in the way journalists go about conceiving of their stories and what they report. On this tape that was leaked yesterday by this Project Veritas, there's a statement that rang true to me, and that was the notion that the viewers of CNN have been trained or expect the kind of anti-Trump stories that CNN has put out. And I think that's worth exploring because in some ways the viewers of CNN are very different than the viewers of Fox. Their expectations are different. And that's that may be more so what guides CNN and Fox than who the advertisers are.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Will, I know you want to add something.
Yeah, well, a couple things. Well, one, I mean, the money thing, I think – obviously, it's an issue, and partly because journalistic organizations are – many of them are struggling. But I thought the way it played out in the last 2 years has been, the way that the cable TV outlets on news chased ratings. Certainly, the coverage of Trump, especially when his campaign started in 2015, when you would see 40-minute blocks of his rallies, constantly cutting away from the other 20 candidates who were in the race at that time to run huge blocks of Trump and really, really promoting his campaign because he was an entertainer. entertainers. You know, the other people were actually talking about policies. Trump was an entertainer. You didn't know what he was going to say next, and it was great for the ratings. And, you know, I talked to people, and even not just at CNN and not just at Fox, MSNBC, which at the time was supposedly had a more progressive bent, but had the same addiction to Trump because they wanted the ratings. And, you know, and look, that happens in, you know, newsrooms like the one I work in. It's clicks, not ratings, but they're the same pressure. So to me, that's how money plays out.
Josh, there was an interesting piece in Politico, Trump's fake war on the fake news. Let me just quote something here. The great secret of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is that Trump's war on the media is a phony one, a reality show that keeps his supporters fired up and distracted while he woos the constituency that really matters to him, journalists. Do you agree with that, Josh?
To some extent, yes. I mean, you have a president who, you know, does lengthy off-the-record interviews on the back of his plane, who brings supporters into the Oval Office, you know, who spends hours a day, you know, reading and watching the news and cares very deeply about his perception on the news. In fact, some of his advisors have told us that, you know, his news coverage often guides his decisions on major issues. And the president, you know, has this constant war that's often phony on the media, and I don't think his supporters realize that, you know, he's so obsessed with his news coverage, and that for, you know, decades in New York he was an anonymous source who called Page
Six, right,
and leaked to them. I don't think they realize that. So there's this kind of split screen where you have a president who, you know, probably more than any president we've seen in a long time, you know, deeply cares about what the media thinks of him and what his coverage looks like. But yet he, you know, tells his supporters when he goes out to these rallies in Pennsylvania or Ohio or where have you, you know, the fake news, the very fake news, and they boo CNN. And then you have a president who, you know, even on the campaign trail would call the control rooms of these TV networks and try to influence his coverage. It's a bit silly, but I think in a matter of his political base, it often works for him, but it's not something that I think he feels deep down. I do think he dislikes a lot of his media coverage, but I think he cares very much about his media coverage.
Well, Josh Jossi, thanks for joining us once again on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's a White House reporter for Politico. Will Bunch is going to stay with us for the rest of the hour, along with Paul Farhi. Paul's the Washington Post media reporter. And Will Bunch is a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, Philly.com, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Again, talking about the relationship between the press and the president. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, we are talking about the changing landscape of journalism in the age of Donald Trump. And again, our guests are Paul Farhi. He's media reporter for The Washington Post, and Will Bunch, who's a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, Philly.com, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we just said goodbye to Politico White House reporter Josh Dossi. Well, we want to say hello to you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Lots of comments here. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me read a bunch of comments we have here. One from Neil: Trump's anti-media attitude is part of his attempt to be an autocrat in the mold of Putin. An email from Warren: does the White House not expect the media to reflect to some extent the way they run things? Confusion breeds confusion. An email from Ed: bashing the press is a tactic by Trump and his helpers. Making idiotic rules about shooting and taping briefings will make the responsible press revolt. A tweet from Grant: the news media must get back to their roots. CNN, MSNBC, Fox, etc. are op-ed shows. They talk about stuff continuously. Let me pick up on that last one, Paul, and put it to you. Is there a kind of a bleeding between reporters and analysts and opinion makers, where you begin to see reporters opining about President Trump or the White House or Congress when really they should stick to the facts?
Yes, absolutely. If you watch any of the cable networks in prime time, the highest rated period, you will see not news, but the discussion of news. And the discussion of news takes place among a host, a political operative, maybe a journalist, and maybe a strategist of some partisan stripe. This is a complete confusion to the viewer who cannot tell one from the other, opinion from fact, and news from, you know, editorializing. It would be as if my stories were written by the political party I might be writing about with my name on it and somebody else's name on it. So the point is this discussion has led to, I think, widespread confusion about what even the news is anymore. The idea of a person standing up with a microphone reporting from the scene, you know, the reporter with a pad and pencil, it's sort of given way to this blur, a big blur.
Does that worry you, Will?
It does. You know, one of the interesting phenomenons I think we've seen in the last couple of years is, you know, when Trump began his rise, you had networks, especially CNN, but the others to a certain extent, who realized, you know, that the group of informed, intelligent people that they relied on, their analysts, none of those people supported Donald Trump. And it's like, oh my gosh, how do we, you know, this guy could be president, how do we reflect his viewpoint? And you went out and you see these people like Jeffrey Lord is the one who gets mentioned
on
most
CNN.
Often, who basically are, you know, or Corey Lewandowski, who was Trump's campaign manager, was hired by CNN the minute he left the campaign, even though he retained ties to the campaign. And you had this weird scenario where these people are being paid by CNN and on the air constantly, not because they're experts, but because their sole job is they're people who are articulate to some degree and can defend Trump. And I mean, I think that's a very alarming trend. And as Paul was referencing, I mean, you see these people on panels where you're mixing, you know, a working journalist like, you know, Maggie Haberman from the New York Times or Robert Costa from the Washington Post will be on a panel, and here's Jeffrey Lord, and that is where you see bleeding. I mean, I'm an opinion journalist, and I think there's a place for opinion, but it does when
there's a place for reporting too,
right? And when those lines get blurred, it doesn't mm-hmm. help.
I don't have any problem with putting a Jeffrey Lord or Kayleigh McEnany on the panel. This is an attempt to be balanced. This is an attempt to reflect another viewpoint, to reflect the Trump viewpoint. Now, you could argue about what specifically they say, but the notion of having someone from, quote, the other side is a very good one. And they need to reflect those sides because he's president of the United States. So mm-hmm. let's give him his due and let's hear what they have to say. It can't all be one side, and it certainly can't all be just journalists. But the larger trend of this blurring, I do think, is kind of destructive.
Well, Douglas from Phoenixville was complaining about, said that, you know, there's money to be made in the kind of journalism that's happening. And Paul, you see that ratings are up for all the cables. I know the subscriptions are up for the Washington Post and New York Times, probably right. other news outlets. So there is money being made off of the Trump presidency.
Good. I mean, it supports journalists. It supports the provision and proliferation of the news. Why is this a bad thing?
No, I'm just saying. I think for people like Douglas, not to speak for him out of turn here, but I think for some people they say, oh, you know, it's all about ratings. It's all about money. It's all about the bottom line, forgetting that it's also all about really journalism. And it seems like we're in a real heyday of journalism these days, talking about, frankly, your paper, The Washington Post, Paul Fahey, The New York Times, and others.
Yeah, but, you know, that's a very false notion and a very false idea. If you go to Chattanooga or Seattle or Phoenix, those papers are not prospering. The media in those places is having a very hard time. And it's neither a Trump phenomena nor not a Trump phenomena. It's about the basic economics of the news business, which these days are very, very bad. So you could look at the Post, the Times, CNN, Fox, the big outlets, the national outlets, they're doing okay. It's the rest of the country that's doing quite poorly.
Is it kind of best of times, worst of times, you think, for journalism, Paul?
Yes, I do. It's very hard to be a journalist in a place like Phoenix or a place like St. Louis. There have been layoffs for years and years. There's more coming. The news business has flattened out and some would say flatlined. In places like New York or Washington, journalism is doing pretty good, and it's a good place to be a journalist. But the landscape is very uneven, and there are places where there is very little reporting going on because the economic circumstances aren't great.
Well, you had a piece yesterday in the paper, and this was about these press conferences where the cameras are turned off. And essentially you said in your story, turn them on. When Sean Spicer says keep the cameras off, you kind of ended your piece saying, no, turn them on, keep them on. Are you asking for the press to, in a sense, defy what the White House is saying?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I think, you know, as both Paul and I were discussing, and we might disagree to some degree on the extent, but I think a lot of people in the media and outside the media agree that this Trump presidency is not normal, to use a phrase that was popular. This is not a normal situation, that the treatment of the press, from, you know, the verbal treatment, the harassment, the abuse, and then also from the kind of restrictions that you're seeing from the Trump White House are not normal restrictions. So at some point, the question becomes, you know, is there a line that has been crossed or that will be crossed where journalists need to do something more than just, you know, and what you have now is, you know, Jim Acosta and Brian Karem and some others have used, you know, either Twitter or Brian Karem's, you know, little mini speech at the briefing yesterday to call attention to it. But, you know, I think at some point, I think journalists are in a difficult spot. You know, obviously, you know, if journalists said, we're going to boycott these briefings because we don't agree to these restrictions, or if they said, you know, we're going to turn the camera on and see what happens. What are you going to do to us? Are you going to arrest us? I mean, if they did those things, you know, all hell would break loose. You know, Breitbart and everybody would be saying, here's the partisan media taking sides against Trump. But I think at some point, if you're a journalist, free, you know, the freedom of the press and the First Amendment is not an on the one hand, on the other hand issue. Healthcare can be on the one hand, on the other hand issue. The First Amendment is not. I mean, if you're a journalist, you have to fight for the First Amendment. And if the administration is going to up the ante to this level, at some point, it's like, do we have to fight more aggressively? I think they should. I think it's crossed that point.
The idea of a protest, is that your version of a fight?
Yeah. I mean, will it happen? I mean, you're talking about journalists colluding, to use a popular term, and journalists aren't very good at collusion. Yeah, right. I mean, you've got bosses who are going to be saying, "What the hell are you doing?" So, you know, it's complicated. But I mean, realistically, I think journalists need to find some venue, some format to say these are not normal times. You know,
and enough is enough.
And there's a real threat to democracy going on right here. I think absolutely.
What do you think, Paul? And are we at that point?
Well, I think we have seen, you know, elements of protest, but it's impossible to get journalists to agree on anything. There's a sort of mutually assured destruction. If you're not going to cover it, I'm going to cover it, and I will gain the advantage by doing so. And the White House knows they can play everybody off each other. You know, but that, on the other hand, is within CNN's power, it is within MSNBC or Fox's power to defy them and face the consequences by turning the cameras on. I expect it will happen because, you know, the photo op is going to be dramatically in favor of the media. The idea of the administration trying to silence a media outlet by forcing its cameras or hauling its reporters out of the briefing room is going to be, you know, the kind of thing that is a nightmare for the administration. So I won't be surprised if it happens and when it happens, but I just think getting any kind of agreement among a group of reporters is very difficult.
I noticed in the New York Times, I think it's David Leonhardt has this long list of what he calls the president's lies. It goes on, I have to say, you know, it seems to go on forever. What do you think about calling the president a liar, Bill Bunch?
You know,
especially the press doing that.
Well, I think all his statements need to be analyzed. And, you know, when he gives a statement of fact, when he says that the crowd at his inauguration was the largest crowd ever and we can look at the pictures and compare them to other inaugurations and see. I don't know any other word for something like that than a lie, you know. And it's happened on issues that are much more important, you know, whether the Obama administration was wiretapping Trump Tower, for example. I mean, these, you know, I think to let these statements go unchallenged is dangerous. And I think, you know, I think if you can really report objectively that the facts are the other way, then it's a lie.
What do you think, Paul? And I've heard all sorts of euphemisms and exaggeration, and, you know, I mean, there are many euphemisms for the word lie.
I don't think it's really necessary for technical reasons. First of all, you're right. We can call it other things. It's baseless. It's untrue. It's wrong. But a lie is when a person knows that something is untrue and they say it anyway. What do we know about Trump's state of mind? We don't know what he believes. And for all, you know, appearances, he may very well believe the extremely baseless, wrong, and exaggerated statements that he's making. So to call it out, it doesn't necessarily require calling it a lie. It makes partisans feel very good to hear that word, but I really don't think you even need to go that far.
He said 3 million fraudulent votes were cast in the election.
Yeah, that's wrong.
That's a lie. It's a lie, Paul. I mean,
he may very well believe what he is saying for all we know. Again, this is not to say that what he is saying is true. It's clearly untrue. But lie implies knowledge of a person's intent and motive.
I understand that. But I think in his case, he's the president of the United States. He has enormous ability. You know, when it comes to who was wiretapping or not wiretapping Trump Tower, he has the ability to pick up the phone and get that information. And instead, he's saying something that is not true when he has the full capacity that in a way that you or I don't have to get the right information. And
there you go. You just
said
it. It's untrue. Problem solved.
true. Problem solved.
I think we live in extraordinary times, and we need to convey that. That's my opinion.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. But Paul, are you saying? I mean, we have done shows about, so what do we call all this stuff? But if someone has chosen not to know something, I think this is what Will is saying.
Yeah.
Chosen not to know something when they could educate themselves about something. You know, what do we call that person?
Well, listen, I'm a reporter. I got to stick to facts. Will is an opinion journalist.
Right.
He can call it whatever he thinks it is. But from the perspective of trying to play it as straight as possible, I don't know if it's a lie. So I'm not going to call it that. And we're really ultimately arguing semantics
sure.
here.
Of course.
We want I think people want the emotional thrill of saying, yes, now we've called it what it is. It's a lie. It's equally accurate to call it untrue, baseless, wrong, etc. So I'm going to stick with my course. You guys can do as you please.
And I have to say, on NPR, I mean, we don't use that
yeah,
word
right, of
for,
course,
for,
yeah.
for all those reasons that Paul just said.
But, you know, when Paul says it's emotionally satisfying, I mean, it's more than that, too. I think, you know, I think people are frustrated that there's a lack of consequences for this. And I think the increasing use of the term lie is partly a reflection of just frustration that people can tell, call it an untruth if you want, but the fact that the president can tell so many untruths and that there's just no recourse.
The recourse is we can document those and we can tell people. You know, I've often said
that it hasn't stopped them. It hasn't
we can lead people to water. Whether they want to drink that water is up to them. All of the fact checking, all of the documentation here really leads to an unmistakable conclusion that these things are very, very wrong and that he is factually off. And, you know, that's as far as I'm willing to go.
Well, I would love to go on because this is fascinating, but the clock tells me we have to end our discussion. Paul Farhi, thank you, as always, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he is media reporter for The Washington Post. Will Bunch, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Marty.
You're
I enjoyed
welcome.
It.
I did as well. And he's national columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Philly.com. And you can check out his blog called Attitude, A-T-T-Y-T-O-O-D. That's how we say that here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.